In the evening, he caught three more minnows, eating two and saving the third for breakfast. The sun had dried stray shreds of moss, and he was able to warm himself with hot water. He had not covered more than 10 miles that day, and the next day, traveling whenever his heart permitted him, he covered no more than 5 miles. But his stomach did not give him the slightest uneasiness. It had gone to sleep. He was in a strange country, too, and the caribou were growing more plentiful. Also, the wolves. Often their yelps drifted across the desolation, and once he saw three of them slinking away before his path. In Jack London's 1907 story, Love of Life, and in many other stories of the wild, wolves are unwelcome intruders who seem to show up when life has reached its lowest ebb. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
As Wisconsin's wolf population increases rapidly, what are we learning about how wolves interact with people? 20 years ago, what led wildlife experts to think that we needed more wolves? From a human standpoint, how many wolves are too many? Giving us some insight into Wisconsin's wolves and the general phenomenon of America's rising wolf population are Adrian Trevis, a professor at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison, and Lisa Naughton, a professor with the Department of Geography at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Delighted to be here.
Before we talk about specifically the wolf population in Wisconsin and its history, can we just talk a little bit about the wolf itself? I think, you know, those howls immediately evoke a kind of visceral reaction. And we can think of all those children's stories where the wolf is the one that blows down the house or eats up Red Riding Hood or does some terrible things. Can you talk about the wolf itself and what it does to our kind of emotions?
Yeah, I think whatever side of the issue you happen to be on, there's a lot of loaded symbolism associated with that creature, the gray wolf, and in many different parts of the world as well. Their range extends all the way through Asia and Europe and, of course, into Canada and our country.
Indeed, the wolves stir strong emotion among just about everyone. For most of our country's history, at least for Euro-Americans, wolves have stirred fear and hostility, and part of taming our wilderness and promoting progress was cleaning the landscape, literally, of wolves, getting rid of wolves in the name of progress. That kind of attitude still persists among some people, certainly those who are living off the land and more likely to encounter wolves. But the removal of wolves and their complete elimination also stirred a counter sentiment. And among many people, particularly people in urban areas, wolves are symbolic of a lost, innocent wilderness. And wolves, as animals, can do no wrong and are somehow sacred. So this intelligent, adaptable canid is laden with symbolism on both sides. And our challenge today is to try to find something perhaps more in the middle that allows us to coexist with these creatures.
Now, as a husband and wife team coming from slightly different disciplines, what got you interested in wolves? Was it the romance or was it something more technical and scientific?
For me, it was technical and scientific fascination with the conflict people run into in living in the sharing the land with wolves. Here in Wisconsin, the farmers who are raising livestock and poultry and in some cases farmed trophy deer often face, not often, but occasionally face wolf attacks on their domestic animals. And hunters who use dogs have also faced the attacks of wolves on their hunting dogs, which are often really valued pets, even considered family members by some hunters.
I was inspired to study wolves as a scientist, but more as a social scientist. I'm intrigued by how people's attitudes and perceptions of nature are rooted in their experiences and in their culture. I grew up in Wisconsin, and for me it was fascinating to learn about this new era in Wisconsin environmental history when we're witnessing a recovery of wolves, and how do people respond to that?
Were they ever completely gone from Wisconsin?
Yeah, by the mid-1950s, after there had been a long period of a state bounty, the wolves were eliminated from the state until the mid to late 70s, and partly under the protection of the Federal Endangered Species Act, but also habitat restoration that we achieved in Wisconsin. Those factors and maybe changing societal views of nature allowed the wolves to come back, and they seem to have come back from Minnesota, and they did so without direct intervention by people. They came back on their own and recolonized the northwestern portion of Wisconsin.
Can we get some facts on the wolf itself? To what extent is it different than the dog? To what extent is it a threat? In other words, when you mention threats to livestock or to hunting dogs, or if somebody's just out in the woods and they see a wolf, what is the danger or the lack of danger?
Well, they're genetically very closely related to our domestic dogs, even though the domestic dog has taken on so many different forms through our intervention, through our selective breeding for certain traits in our companion animals. The wolf is genetically related to the dog and yet tends to be larger than most domestic dogs that we're familiar with and lives in a pack structure that might be a little unfamiliar, except for your listeners who have a large number of dogs living at home.
Perhaps too many.
Maybe. The danger to people is extremely small if you're considering other risks such as traffic accidents or diseases that affect people. And in fact, there's a sort of a lively debate going on right now about how much should we be worried about wolf attacks on people. And the basis for that debate is that there are really no documented cases in the lower 48 states of the United States, no documented cases of a wild, healthy wolf attack on people. However, it's happened in Canada and Alaska with some debate about whether those wolves were being fed by the people, whether the wolves were actually healthy, had they been captive before. So you see, it's kind of a nuanced debate, and there's no simple answer. I think the managers in Wisconsin are quite aware of the possibility of a wolf attack. There's a deep historical record in Europe and India of rare but occasional attacks on people.
And why then would a healthy wolf, assuming this has happened, attack a person?
I don't have a good answer for that. Generally, they're adapted. Their ancestry is adapted to attacking ungulate prey like deer and elk. So occasionally, any carnivore will switch prey or opportunistically take food of any sort. That's true of all large carnivores, whether you're talking about leopards, tigers, bears. And so, you know, you can imagine that an adaptable creature like the wolf, driven to a certain extreme, might go for a novel and unusual prey item. One should note, however, that our history of interaction of coexisting with wolves has mainly been humans destroying, killing wolves. And so they have evolved a healthy fear of us. And that's a fear that we probably want to maintain. I'm not saying that that requires that we kill more wolves, but I'm saying that that distance that we've established, that fear they have for us, is probably a good thing, considering the landscapes in Wisconsin that are human-dominated.
We have some lessons from learning to coexist or trying to learn to coexist with other large carnivores like black bears or mountain lions, that risk emerges very rarely, but risk emerges when, in essence, both sides, the people and the large carnivore, lose fear of one another. If people begin to start feeding bears and approaching them and treating them almost as if they're domestic animals or pets, that's where injury is a risk.
Other differences between wolves and dogs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but adult wolves don't bark, do they?
No, that's a juvenile characteristic of wolves.
Is it bred into dogs?
And it seems to have been retained in adult dogs. Maybe we liked it.
And why do they howl at the moon?
You'd have to ask Adrian Weideven, who's with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and a close colleague of ours. He's really the expert on behavior and biology of wolves in Wisconsin. I have a suspicion that the howling at the moon is just our seeing a pattern where there is none. Wolves howl for territorial reasons. They're defending their pack territory from neighbors and intruders. There's quite a lot of movement of dispersing wolves in wolf society, and therefore a pack who wants to retain its pack stability and integrity and maintain the boundaries of its territory needs to repel outsiders at certain points, or repel newcomers. And there is conflict between neighboring wolf packs where they will kill each other. However, having said that, the predominant cause of mortality for wolves is humans. And that's true around the world, but especially true in here in Wisconsin, where it can easily exceed 55% of all adult mortality.
And what are some of the motives for killing wolves besides sort of, you know, just because you can do it because there's fear of them? Is it the fur? Is it mostly to keep them away from livestock? What are some of the reasons people kill wolves?
Actually, the predominant cause are shootings, for which the reason isn't known because the actor's not found. And the second most common cause are vehicle collisions, some of which could be accidental, some of which might be intentional. We don't know. And then there's some isolated cases of poisoning, errors in trapping, where a legally trapped species was targeted and yet a wolf was caught in the trap. There are some cases of shooting wolves in the act of threatening livestock, and that is currently legal under the current classification of wolves in the state and by the federal government.
How do you contrast then wolves and coyotes in terms of the way they interact with people and livestock?
I guess I would say that people don't have the same feeling of personal fear of coyotes as wolves. Wolves are larger. They travel in somewhat larger packs depending on conditions, and therefore people tend to tolerate coyotes more. But a big difference has more to do with our politics than the biology of coyotes and wolves, namely that the politics allow fairly liberal control of coyotes, and until recently wolves were strictly protected. That made people resent the threat to their domestic animals that wolves posed. The fact that the federal government and the state government were protecting the wolf reduced people's tolerance because they didn't feel that they could handle the threat themselves. They had to call a state agent or a federal agent for help. And that kind of thing makes people angry. Everybody likes to be able to manage their own difficulties rather than calling
it's the American way.
Yep.
What do you find would be the most common misconceptions about wolves in Wisconsin or the history of wolves in Wisconsin?
Well, I've, in talking to people and corresponding with people, bumped into two stereotypes that are polar opposites of how wolves will behave around people. There are some who believe that any wolf will kill livestock or kill a pet if it's given the chance, that all wolves are, in their words, depredators. On the other hand, there are people who believe that no wolf would cause that kind of threat unless it were ill or old. The reality is, and this is here work that Adrian's published, but is that most wolf packs in the Wisconsin landscape have access to domestic animals in their territories and cause no problems, do not attack them. Most wolves out there are not causing any problems. There are isolated packs who become habitual depredators, if you will, and become a real problem for the livestock producers living in that area.
Of course, dogs have been known to do the same thing in packs. So there are these behavioral differences within any given species.
Yep. Indeed, and back to comparing dogs and wolves, which is a fascinating comparison in my mind, feral dogs and loose dogs certainly kill a lot more livestock, threaten more people, attack more people, orders of magnitude greater than what wolves do. But it's a whole different mindset on how we embrace risk from dogs than how we feel about risk from what some people would call the federal animals.
So the burgeoning wolf population in Wisconsin, which as I seem to remember from when I first came here in the mid-80s, the population was something like 24. And Minnesota had, 48, all those wolves. And now we're talking about, 550 wolves in Wisconsin? What exactly has accounted for that phenomenon? I mean, was it then protected in Minnesota and there weren't enough to protect in Wisconsin and they spilled over, as you described, Adrian? Or exactly where did they all come from?
Well, Minnesota has vast areas of suitable habitat for wolves, and their current population's estimated – I'm not an expert on Minnesota, but their current population's estimated around 2,000. And our population and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan's population, as you said, is around 550 each. And partly the population explosion in after the 80s is testament to the suitability of the habitat, the abundant deer population. The white-tailed deer is the primary prey of wolves in our area. Those two factors allowed the wolf population to increase at 10 to 20% per year.
Why all of a sudden, though? What changed in the habitat in the 80s?
Well, it's more that there were two disease factors in the 80s that kept the wolf population down. And after the survivors of this, those two diseases, once they had gotten through it and their pups began to survive again, the natural fecundity or reproductive speed of the wolves could reinstall itself. And then we saw effectively what one would predict for a healthy wolf population recovering without exploitation by people. And there have been studies in Canada that led us could tell us what to expect from such a wolf population, and Wisconsin and Michigan's followed the predictions.
And what are some of the benefits of having a wolf population besides the sort of romantic satisfaction of knowing they're out there? I assume control of the deer population is one of them. But
yeah, I'm glad you asked that because sometimes it's overlooked. Wolves perform a very important regulating function in ecosystems, and this has been demonstrated most clearly in Yellowstone and in Isle Royale National Park, where the wolves never eliminate the elk or the moose or the deer where they live, but they take a few of them and they change the behavior of those prey. So the deer or the elk, if you're out in Yellowstone, the deer will change where they're foraging and where they spend time and the numbers of them that will aggregate or disaggregate. Those patterns of behavior among the deer will change. And we behavioral ecologists suspect that that changes our human perceptions of the abundance of deer or elk, whereas there's two things going on, a small decrease in the number of deer and a big change in their behavior that will reduce the deer's browsing pressure on plants, and that can allow some of the native plants to recover from over-browsing by deer. So as you know, we have a lot of deer. Some experts are telling us that there's superabundant, overabundance of deer, that they're damaging our ecosystem.
They're damaging my yard right now.
Yeah, a lot of people see the effects individually, personally, for themselves. And what seems to be happening, some of our colleagues, Dean Anderson and Don Waller — Dean Anderson was formerly at UW-Madison. He's now with the Forest Service. And Don Waller, who's in the Department of Botany at Madison. They showed that the pattern of deer foraging at the center of wolf packs was very different from the pattern of deer browsing and foraging beyond those wolf packs. And the consequence was a very complicated change in the plant diversity, but something more akin to the previous historical native conditions of plants within the wolf pack territories. And let me add just one more factor that wolves do. They will often control the number of coyotes inside the wolf pack territories. So wolves and coyotes are highly antagonistic to each other. Coyotes inevitably lose in that contest.
I would think so, yes.
And one sees a depletion of the number of coyotes within the wolf pack territories. One angle in my future research I'm trying to explore is, how does that affect farmers? If there are fewer coyotes, but there are wolves, are they losing more or less than they used to? Because coyotes are the predominant agricultural predator in the country, and that could have a positive effect for farmers.
I would just like to add that it's so exciting to us to see these kinds of results in a place like Wisconsin. That is, Anderson and Waller documenting wolves resuming their ecosystem functions and actually aiding the recovery of some of our endangered plant species at the core of their territories. At the core of wolf packs in Wisconsin territories, you find greater plant cover and a greater diversity of the plants that are there, including endangered plant species that have been devoured by our superabundant deer everywhere else. That's the kind of result we're perhaps expecting in a fantastic, vast wilderness like Yellowstone. But to see that ecosystem recovery and those relationships recovering in a place like Wisconsin, We don't have vast wildernesses. This is a very human, modified, and inhabited landscape. To me, that's a thrill to see that recovery amidst a humanized landscape.
Just to, on a tangential angle here, how long have the deer been burgeoning like this? I mean, the deer have really had a holiday till recently, haven't they? Well, what's going on with that? Where have all the deer come from? Has it been traditionally that big a problem in Wisconsin, has it?
No, in fact, deer were considered a threatened species in the state for many decades ago. I don't know the exact figures on their recovery.
In the early 20th century, they were all but extirpated throughout much of Wisconsin because of over-hunting. But thanks to the removal of predators and to the land use practices that we've promoted since then, and to hunting regulations that, for example, target the bucks above the does, all those factors together have favored this late 20th century explosion of deer populations. And we have a near world record density of deer in our state. I guess Pennsylvania is our
rival.
Yeah,
rival.
They have them actually on the airport runway.
More on the wolf when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Fox Cities Book Festival, connecting authors and readers, featuring nearly 40 authors throughout Appleton and the Fox Cities April 16th through the 20th. Information at foxcitiesbookfestival.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests for this hour, Adrian Trevis and Lisa Naughton. They are experts on Wisconsin's wolves. We started with a quotation from Jack London, but he really doesn't talk that much about wolves. He actually talks more about hybrids, crosses between dogs and wolves. Now, how do we sort it all out? Is that a common phenomenon in Wisconsin?
Yeah, common enough that almost every year the state has to respond to a complaint about a so-called wolf, and then the investigators from the Federal Wildlife Services discover that it's in fact more likely a hybrid animal based on physical features or behavioral traits. The hybridization of dogs and wolves leaves traces behind that can be detected by an expert, such as eye color, posture of the ears, body proportions, coloration of the fur. And hybrids in particular, if they've been raised in captivity, as most of them have, are attracted to people. They're drawn to people because they realize food comes from people. They may have had a bond with people in the past. That makes them particularly dangerous if they've become aggressive and are attracted to people.
There was one rather alarming incident a few years ago where children at a playground in northern Wisconsin were feeding their lunch, their sandwiches, to what appeared to be a pack of big wolves, which were wolf-dog hybrids. And that's the kind of interaction that one doesn't want in the landscape.
Do we have these situations, as you sometimes hear about, where people have wild animals for pets? You know, they grow up with a cheetah or something cuddly like that, which is fine for a couple of years, and then suddenly it turns. Do we see that phenomenon with hybrids? And I gather wolves really don't make great pets.
No, I don't think they make great pets. There's a surprising number of these hybrid cases where the hybrid escaped, and I'm not sure if that's a deliberate release or the animal dug under its enclosure and got out. The case of the hybrids is really problematic because for those people who attach status to having a wolf as a pet, they may be unaware of the danger posed to other people if that animal escapes. And it also creates a misperception about the wild wolves that they're
friendlier than they really are.
Coming to playgrounds, for instance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I lived in Australia, there were dingo. Now, is that a wolf-dog kind of hybrid?
The dingo is a domestic dog that went feral quite a ways back, so it has a lot of traits that are unfamiliar to us in our domestic dogs.
Is this an increasing situation, though, where we actually have wolves at the edge of populated areas the way we do with coyotes?
Yes, certainly. The wolves in much of the upper Midwest, we could say Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin, have now occupied, or you could say saturated, the suitable wolf habitat, that is open spaces and forest cover and wild areas. And the population continues to grow, so they keep moving south and moving closer toward inhabited areas. There's a lively debate, as you can imagine, between different schools of thought about how to manage wolves, whether we should proactively discourage and even kill wolves as they enter the more densely settled parts of our state before those wolves cause a problem, or another school, wait to see if, in fact, conflicts emerge and then respond and eliminate those packs.
A footnote to all this, is for your listeners who aren't familiar with Wisconsin, is that our state has very few wild areas. There's no national parks that are of a substantial size to hold even a single wolf pack. And therefore, the recovery of wolves in Wisconsin was on a mosaic of state, county forest lands, industrial timber lands, and private livestock farms, private lands. And that recovery of wolves in this human-dominated landscape occurred with relatively few conflicts, and many of our rural residents being unaware that they lived right near a wolf pack. Partly that's a testament to the adaptability of wolves, that they're avoiding people and able to adapt to the way we transform landscapes. And partly it's a testament to the tolerance that's out there in Wisconsin residents. Obviously not everybody, but at least in our surveys of public opinion, we're finding a very clear majority that are in favor of wolves being present in the state, and very few people who call for eradication of them. So this context, this landscape that we're living in Wisconsin, which is mainly private lands or state and county lands that people use heavily for recreation, including hunting, that's a situation very different from Yellowstone, where there was a large protected area where the wolves could be safe and far from people for a long time. Here, the wolves recovered without that kind of protection. And it's a situation that's more similar to the rest of the world than the case of Yellowstone. The rest of the world is also experiencing the recoveries of various large carnivores, including wolves, brown bears in some places, in a matrix that people are using, private lands and public lands that are heavily used.
Do you find there's, despite that seemingly smooth process of getting the wolves back, that there is a sort of political divide between those in Madison that are making decisions in a sort of urban area and saying this is how you must live with wolves, and then those in parts of the state where they're more directly affected?
Well, Lisa's nodding, but I'm going to shake my head a little bit.
Good, we want a little bit of friction here.
I guess from my viewpoint, I don't think the Madison residents are making a lot of those decisions. I think political interest groups have had a large sway over wolf policy and shaped it in often very interesting ways, although the predominant force has been the federal protections under the Endangered Species Act until last year. And now that the wolf in Wisconsin is delisted, namely taken off the list of threatened and endangered species for the state as well as the federal government, now the authority for control is in the hands of Wisconsin entirely.
I would just add that when you go to a public meeting about wolves, that public meeting will attract the people who feel most strongly about wolves, and thus a public meeting, that's where you'll see the greatest differences between a public meeting in Madison versus a public meeting up in Butternut, Wisconsin, where the narrative up north is very much about this encroaching animal and all the urgency of being able to hunt or, you know, eliminate that wolf if it's threatening your livestock. Whereas in Madison, the narrative is of a victimized species that is still vulnerable and just barely recovering that we need to protect. That's at public meetings. When you talk to people privately, when you ask them to write down their thoughts or respond to a survey, those stark boundaries start to blur, where you find people from the northern part of our state acknowledging the beauty of wolves, their pride that wolves are coming back in our state, their appreciation that some kind of protection and monitoring is appropriate. And on the other side, in Madison, you have people acknowledging that some wolves will need to be eliminated and that perhaps even a public hunt, controlled and
regulated,
might be part of our plan for coexistence.
So does anyone have a sense of numbers? I mean, how many wolves are too many? They do with deer.
We've asked people that question, basically, what is their preferred wolf population size for the state? And when we did our first survey in 2001, the preferred population size hovered around 350, which was the state management – is still the state management goal for the species. When we asked the same question in 2004, that number had crept up closer to 500 when you averaged across all of our respondents, and that was 1,364 people in six zip codes, both rural, urban, northern, and southern parts of Wisconsin. And so what I think – how I interpret that is that people were somewhat aware of the climbing wolf population, the rise in the wolf population, and were not necessarily strongly opposed to that. And in our second survey, we sampled more of the people from – Madison, for instance, was one of the zip codes we sampled. And
I wouldn't know how to answer that because I would want to answer with a number that was the best from an ecological point of view. In other words, what would lead to the best balance in the state? But I wouldn't have that figure. I mean, if somebody put on a survey, how many wolves do you want in your state? I would not have the means to answer that well, I don't think.
My students raised the same objection. We did give the preamble that the Wisconsin DNR presents this number for the winter wolf size. You know, we gave them a different number as the wolf population increased and gave them that as sort of as a basis for framing their response so they could aim for a number that was lower or a number that was higher or write what the DNR was telling them existed in the state. But you raise another good point, which is we don't really know how many wolves the state could hold. Research by a former student of ours, Carrie Martin, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, suggests that the wolves are relaxing the criteria that they employ for new habitat. At least for the dispersing wolves, they're using habitat we once considered unsuitable to
them.
They're
becoming more versatile.
Yeah.
Like coyotes, like mm-hmm. raccoons, like any number of bears,
mm-hmm. yeah.
mm-hmm. any number of other species that thrive by living on the margins between people and the wild.
Exactly. So that raises questions about the future, and we really don't have all the answers.
I would add an anecdote here. This is where I find my colleagues in wildlife management and wildlife ecology frustrated with social science or frustrated with me because they'll ask me, what is the social carrying capacity of wolves? In other words, just how many wolves do people want in the state? And I hem and haw because it's so dependent on, you know, how those wolves are managed and who you're asking. And people again and again have proven themselves to be very tolerant of some problems like wildlife or deer damage causes at least $2 million a year of crop damage, up to $9 million if you start looking at vehicle damage. Yet there's not the outcry over deer numbers as there is over wolves, which are perhaps causing about $90,000 a year of livestock damage
at the
state level.
Well, you get to blast those deer.
So. There's a sense of – that's one of the themes in our research is people tend to tolerate or feel more favorably about an animal that they feel they own or is of benefit to them. So – another similar story with a bear. The bear population in Wisconsin has boomed in recent years and is topping 12,000, perhaps even more in the state. You don't get the same kind of outcry about bear numbers, partly because of our cultural stories about those animals and a fondness of bears. But it's also perhaps due to there's a strong group of people who see bear as game and as part of their recreational life and something that they can interact with. It's not off limits for them.
There's not a bear hunting season in Wisconsin, though, is there?
Yes, there is. More than 70,000 people apply for a permit every year, and it's been increasing 11% every year. So very popular. There's a substantial number of out-of-state applicants.
Taking how many bears every year?
They sell 5,000 permits to take, and about 2,500 every year are fulfilled. So 2,500 bears are harvested in the bear hunting season every year.
Would we be more emotional, do you think, in resisting a wolf hunt?
I think so.
Why do you suppose that difference between bears and wolves?
That romantic?
Back to that aura? They're too dog-like? They're too intelligent? They're too simpatico?
Some people list those attributes as reasons for opposing hunting or opposing lethal control by state agents. It's also possible that it's too new. Some people have said to me, well, they just recovered. It's a little bit early to start hunting wolves, isn't it? And the Federal Endangered Species Act mandates a 5-year monitoring period during which time the states are supposed to provide the federal government with data on the wolf population level and in particular track the threats to the wolves. And that 5-year period is to allow the federal government to do emergency relisting if needed. And that is if there were a sudden spike in those threats, such as human-caused mortality, so the federal government could step in and take control back. Now, Wisconsin state managers have been working for years, if not decades, to gain state authority over the wolves. For them, it would be a disaster to have emergency relisting and the federal government step in again. And therefore, the state is highly motivated to maintain the Wisconsin wolf population above the federal targets. And we don't get a strong sense in the state of Wisconsin that anyone is pushing for such a drastic reduction in the wolf population that there would be a risk of emergency relisting. So again, there's actually common ground about maintaining a wolf population at a certain level.
And right now, what other rules or policies are in place? For example, if you do lose livestock to a wolf, do you get compensated?
Indeed you do. And Wisconsin has one of the most generous compensation policies of any state. You do have to prove that or provide evidence that that loss was caused by a wolf, and there are agents from the Wildlife Services of the Department of Agriculture that will come to your property and collect evidence to confirm whether that was a wolf loss.
You have to put your cow on ice until they get there? How does that work? It sounds like it would be kind of unwieldy.
They're pretty responsive and agile. They're usually out there within 24 hours after you report it, and they look for tracks and bite marks on the animal and use that evidence as the Wildlife Service agents, in essence, are a third-party verifier, which is a nice aspect of our policy. If they say, yes, that was likely a wolf, then the DNR taps into a compensation fund that is generated by voluntary contributions from state citizens. Part of the source of that funding comes from the purchase of those wolf license plates that are quite popular in much of our state, particularly in the southern part of the state.
Yeah, imagine that.
And do you find that it helps in terms of attitudes and tolerance toward wolves when you did the studies that I know your colleagues, you know, might have questioned in terms of accuracy, but could you show a link between people who were compensated for the loss of a wolf and their sort of tolerance of their presence?
That was a key question for our research. Given that Wisconsin has this generous compensation program, what is it buying us? Are we, in essence, paying for tolerance among the people who are living in the land with wolves? By comparing people's attitude towards wolves and their approval of different kinds of management policies, including killing problem wolves, using those kind of attitudes as proxies of tolerance to wolves, and comparing those proxy measures of people who had been compensated versus people who had not been compensated, we found no difference in terms of support for wolves. So at face value, I would argue that paying people compensation does not turn them into wolf huggers. It doesn't change people's attitudes because our attitudes are formed quite early in life, how we're raised, how we make our income, how our parents made their income. However, I do think it's been a good investment in general because having that compensation program in place has bought wolves some political space. If wolf advocates in urban areas were to simply push wolf recovery and offer no help to the people who are actually living with wolves, I think that's a political no-go kind of situation. Having this structure in place such that at least the economic aspect of the risk is mitigated, I think that was important for allowing negotiation between the different parties. I've talked to livestock producers, to hunters who are concerned about their dogs being killed by wolves, who were to say, if there were no compensation program, we wouldn't show up to these round tables. We wouldn't volunteer to start negotiating future rules for wolf management. This is a fair part of managing wolves. So it's a very popular program. That said, I couldn't conclude that those payments win individual people over to the cause of wolves.
How likely is a wolf hunt, and how would it proceed? That and some other questions and answers when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
If you want to know more about HD Radio, there's an article on HD that you'll find at WPR.org, as well as answers to frequently asked questions and related HD Radio links, all at WPR.org.
The shepherd drives the wolf from the sheep, for which the sheep thanks the shepherd as his liberator, while the wolf denounces him for the same act as the destroyer of liberty. Plainly, the sheep and the wolf are not agreed upon a definition of liberty. So said Abraham Lincoln. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Lisa Naughton and Adrian Travis, and we're talking about wolves in Wisconsin. You've been talking about the possibility now that the wolf is delisted from the endangered species list that there might be a wolf hunt. And I'm curious, who gets to decide that and how?
Once the federal government removed the wolf from the list of endangered and threatened species, authority for management of the wolf falls to the state. So in a sense, it's we, the residents of Wisconsin, who get to decide. However, in practice, those decisions are made by the Department of Natural Resources with the advice of the Conservation Congress and through a recommendation to the Natural Resource Board and our state assembly and Senate.
So it's not going to happen overnight, whatever happens.
No.
No, but it's becoming an issue of some urgency in that this very month there will be a formal deliberation on whether we should move forward and establish a plan for eventual public harvest of wolves that will be put to a vote this very month.
And how would a wolf hunt proceed? For example, what areas would you pick? And for that matter, where are the real wolf strongholds? Would you work with them or would you work with the areas where wolves are more encroaching on human populations?
Well, that's an open question. So at this point, I'm going to speak from my personal opinion because there have been no designs of a wolf hunting season laid down. I can speculate without much fear of being wrong. And the idea that has been circulated and that I'm also advocating is that the hunt should be targeted to reduce conflicts with livestock owners. And the reason for this is that there's basic agreement that the hunting season should be sustainable, namely that it doesn't deplete the wolf population, especially not below those federal population targets. And another common thread through all of our surveys and interviews with people and listening to the public meetings is a deep concern about wolf attacks on domestic animals, in particular livestock. And if we can design a hunt that addresses both of those needs, I think we have that elusive win-win situation that people have been looking for so long. And I think it will alleviate people's concerns of an overabundance of wolves, a population out of control, if we can minimize those attacks on domestic animals while generating the proposed benefits of a hunt. And very briefly, those proposed benefits are a steady source of revenue for the DNR to manage wolves and other wildlife.
And to pay compensation.
Yeah.
Instead of relying on these voluntary contributions and license plates, the hunting fees would, in essence, take over that burden of paying for compensation.
How much is that compensation totally? I mean, in the course of a year?
About $110,000 a year these past few years, and that's both livestock, farm deer, and hunting dogs.
So that's really not a fortune in the scheme of things. It's really not that big a phenomenon, at least as being reported and compensated.
It is a fortune for the Endangered Resources Bureau, which has a terrific program responsible not just for wolves, but for whooping cranes and endangered butterflies. And the rising wolf compensation costs is starting to compromise some of the funding for some of these other urgent problems.
Yeah, the people who were looking at the budget for endangered resources in the state had projected 3% of their costs would be wolf compensation costs. It's now risen to 10% for the last few years. This is a big concern for a colleague and a friend of ours, Randall Jurowitz, who works for the Endangered Resources Bureau. He is also detecting decreased contributions, donations to the Endangered Resources Fund. And we're not sure at the moment whether that reflects the worsening economy nationwide or if it reflects some disaffection by donors to the fund with wolf policies, possibly. There's a lot of possible explanations.
Or just plain sort of forgetting the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think there's a danger that people will shoot dogs by mistake? I mean, from a distance,
it's not compensation for that.
Not that easy from a distance, is it, to tell the difference between a dog, a wolf dog, and a wolf?
That is tricky, or coyotes for that matter. It's also not clear how people will choose to hunt wolves, whether it's even possible to do it with a gun or with a bow and arrow versus trapping or using dogs to somehow corner the wolves. So there's many open questions about a possible hunting season.
There's also interesting dilemmas there. Most hunters, the passion for the hunt is they want to commune with nature and they want to be out in a wild place pursuing their game and experiencing nature in a wild sense. Perhaps less excited about tromping around the edge of pastures,
yes.
Pursuing wolves that have a bad habit of eating calves. That has yet to be seen.
So back to Norman's question for a moment. If one were to follow my recommendation of designing a wolf hunting season to reduce conflicts, one would want to focus the energies of hunters to just a handful of wolf packs, because the majority of wolf packs have not caused many problems and, in fact, are coexisting peacefully as much as they seem to be able to with people around them. And so if one focused on those few wolf packs, it creates a situation where one can't issue many permits because there aren't many wolves to hunt. And that would tend to increase the price of each permit, making it really a trophy animal. And we're not sure if that fits in the tradition. I'm not sure if that fits in the tradition and culture of hunting in Wisconsin.
Well, and on a practical level, you'd almost have to identify what these wolf gangs, you know, that sort of the bad wolf packs and try to target where they are. And
You can do that sort of, well, with geography.
The DNR has done a fantastic job for the last 30 years of monitoring our wolf population very intensively with a mixture of radio telemetry and more indirect methods, such as doing winter surveys with volunteers who go out and look for tracks and the DNR biologists who go out and look for tracks. And then they count the wolves on that basis. And in the summertime, they conduct what are called howl surveys, where they howl near the suspected den site.
These researchers howl?
Yeah, the DNR biologists.
Now, there's
howl.
A job I'd like to have.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and apparently you can fool the pups into thinking those are wolves, and the pups will respond. And in that way, the biologists get a sense of whether the pack reproduced successfully and maybe how many pups there are. So this fantastic database of monitoring, mainly based on the radio collaring, of course, which is done by aerial radio telemetry, fixed-wing aircraft flying over the state.
Couldn't you just relocate wolves?
That is, in fact, what the most popular solution to problem wolves is from our respondents to our surveys. People repeatedly ask that question, can't we just move them somewhere else? That was the policy while they were a strictly protected species. Worked for a while, but now our state is so saturated with wolves, it's hard to find a place to move them to. And the survival rate of relocated wolves is quite poor.
They have to compete with other wolves who would be in that habitat.
And I understand that there is a Conservation Congress coming up in Madison, April 14th. Can you tell us about that and how it relates to the wolves?
The Conservation Congress is a formal process for Wisconsin citizens to advise the DNR on environmental policy. It's been proceeding on an annual basis for decades, most historically emphasizing hunting regulations, but increasingly also dealing with pollution issues and other key concerns. This month's meeting in April 14th promises to offer some fireworks, I expect, because they are going to have a formal vote on whether to move forward with a wolf hunt plan. They're also going to deliberate on whether citizens should have the right to kill any wolf that is threatening their domestic animals while on public property. Currently, citizens are only free to do that if the wolf threat is on private property. Those are two hot issues. There will be both a formal vote of elected delegates at that Congress, but there's also opportunity for the public to show up, register their opinion orally or in a written appeal, and it's at the Alliant Energy Center. Details about the schedule would be available at the DNR website.
And you can link to that by going to our website at WPR.org. If I wanted to see a wolf in the wild, how would I go about it?
Your best bet is to go with the pilots who are flying over and doing the aerial radio telemetry I alluded to earlier. That's the only way I've seen a wild wolf in Wisconsin. It's from a plane. They fly at about 300 feet. These are incredible pilots. It was a single-engine plane, a single pilot who was flying the plane at a low altitude and circling the wolves that he detected from their radio collars. He was also taking a GPS reading right there and counting the wolves, and in some cases they can detect mange. If the wolves are particularly scruffy looking, they can detect that from the air. So these pilots are incredible. The DNR has got some great staff.
Sounds like a source of revenue there. Give rides for $100 a trip.
You have to have a strong stomach.
For those hoping to see a wolf by land, the Central Forest area offers the best chance of viewing wolves, particularly those living in and around the cranberry bogs have become more visible to the public. So you could see them potentially at 300 meters.
That's a concern. It's a concern for managers as well, as these wolves seem to be tolerating people watching them. So that habituation raises the concern of wolf attacks on people.
Are other states watching Wisconsin right now to see what we do?
We have that impression. We're asked to talk in various other states and sometimes other countries such as Scandinavia. Sweden's dealing with its own rising wolf population. So yes, other places are watching not only how the state and federal government negotiate the transfer of authority, but they're also watching how wolves do in this heavily humanized landscape that we hold. Which brings me to, I think, what is a very important point about wolves and other large carnivores like grizzly bears. Their fate, their future, really depends on people's tolerance. And we're still learning how to live with them in a way that doesn't destroy either people's livelihoods or the wildlife species that we love to see.
Indeed, most of us have no chance or very remote chance of encountering a large carnivore in our day-to-day lives. But every large carnivore that's existing out there does have a high chance of interacting with people. So they're the ones that are, their fate is determined by what we'll tolerate.
And it must be as frightening for them to look at us as it is for us to look at them.
I would imagine.
Lisa Naughton and Adrian Trevis have been our guests this hour. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a very interesting hour and be interesting to see how all the developments occur with this burgeoning wolf population in Wisconsin and many other parts of the world, too.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.